This week on Making Contact.
The average member of the public doesn't want to believe what's going on in these laboratories all across our nation that our federal tax dollars are funding.
You can try a drug on thousands of mice or rats all you want, but the first people that take those drugs are actually the first guinea pigs, so to speak.
Medical researchers and drug companies use millions of animals each year for laboratory experiments. Government agencies require that animal tests only take place when other methods are unavailable, and the animals need to be treated humanely. On this program, we take a look at the Animal Welfare Act and at current debates about whether animal tests are necessary and reliable enough to ensure human health. I'm Stephanie Welch, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In 1966, the streets became safer for cats and dogs, thanks to the passage of the Laboratory Animal Welfare Act. At the time, pet theft was a problem. Animals were disappearing and ending up at research institutions, where they were subjected to experiments unregulated by government agencies. Over the years, amendments strengthened the legislation, which became known as the Animal Welfare Act. It regulates the care and treatment of warm-blooded animals that are bred for commercial sale, transported commercially, exhibited to the public, or used in research. Mice, rats, and birds make up 95% of animals used in research, but are not protected under the Act. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, up to 25 million rats and mice are used each year for experiments. The department doesn't track the number of birds that are used. Jim Rogers is a spokesperson for the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which administers the Act.
When we check out a research lab, we are looking for the minimum standards of care under the Animal Welfare Act. Are the animals being properly fed? Are they being properly cared for? Are they placed in the proper housing? It's from those reports that we can make a determination of whether or not to more seriously examine a facility. Let's say we go somewhere. We look in their med cabinet and we find expired medication. That would be a non-compliant item, and it's very easily correctable. They throw away the expired medication and they're back in compliance, and we don't have a problem. But let's say for the next three times we show up and they have that problem, the same problem repeatedly, then we may say to ourselves, you know, there's a problem here beyond what we're seeing. We should investigate that, at which point we would open an official investigation to examine why they keep having these expired medications in their cabinet.
The Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service conducts on-the-spot inspections on the average of twice a year at any given facility. Marshall Smith worked for the USDA for nearly 19 years. He was a senior investigator and conducted inspections and investigations at facilities that supplied animals for research. Smith says that violations of the Animal Welfare Act are widespread. He eventually quit because he says the agency wasn't allowing him to do his job.
They're not seriously committed to enforcing the Animal Welfare Act. They've been known to pressure inspectors, including those with degrees in veterinary medicine, to ignore violations of the Animal Welfare Act in their official reports. They were allowing individuals to house animals in substandard, miserable conditions without any sanctions against these people. And it was just, I just couldn't tolerate it.
Jim Rogers disagrees that the agency is lax in its enforcement of the Animal Welfare Act.
Animal care is at its highest number of inspectors ever, with 96 inspectors nationwide. We received more than $5 million over our budget last year, this year for use. And even when we didn't have the high number of inspectors, we continued to have proper inspections. We continued to have cases brought against people that were or that we believed were violating the law. And we continued to work to the best of our ability.
Rogers says that the USDA recently fined the University of Connecticut $129,000 for violations, including inadequate veterinary care, substandard conditions, and stocking medication that had expired. The largest fine they ever brought against a facility was $450,000. Suzanne Roy is program director of the Animal Rights Group, In Defense of Animals. She was pleased with the action against the University of Connecticut, but she says that these fines are usually just slaps on the wrist, and that the USDA rarely takes significant enforcement action against the more prestigious institutions, such as the University of California at San Francisco. Roy took her case to court to obtain documents pertaining to UCSF's oversight of animal research conducted on its campus.
Since February 1998, the USDA has cited UCSF 9 times for violations of the Animal Welfare Act. And they generally visit UCSF 2 times a year, and almost every inspection has found rampant violations of the Animal Welfare Act. The USDA inspector has come across, just on his random inspections, terrible animal cruelty. He's found lambs frothing at the mouth and gasping for breath because they had been subjects of surgery and then left aside unmonitored following the surgery. He found a lamb whose surgical wound had opened and become infected and was untreated and was given no pain relief for 10 days until the inspector pointed it out. And this is someone who's there just twice a year. The fundamental violations that they've found there repeatedly over and over are failure to provide animals with adequate veterinary care and failure to oversee animal research in accordance with federal law.
Roy says that a number of experiments that UCSF conducts are not necessary to ensure human health, including subjecting monkeys to sound blasting experiments to study brain damage caused by loud noises. Another involves using monkeys to determine how the brain controls eye movements. Roy says the researcher, who brings in millions of dollars to the university, has been doing the same experiments for over 20 years.
He may claim clinical relevance, but we're not aware of any medical breakthrough that has come from this research. And we are aware that there are better ways of doing it that don't involve torturing monkeys. And he literally is torturing monkeys. They are kept in his lab for up to 3 years at a time with all these metal plates and bolts in their heads and metal coils in their eyes, and they're chained on metal leashes 24 hours a day in their cage, and they're led by a pole on their leash to a restraining chair where they have to sit for 8 hours at a time and follow light in a certain pattern to make their eyes move with electrodes in their brain. They put eyeglasses on that the monkeys can't get off to distort their vision. Besides all that, they deprive them of water to keep them thirsty so that when they put them in the restraining chairs, they'll perform for a juice reward. And one of the things that the USDA cited them for was not only failing to ensure that the monkeys got enough to drink and to eat, but also that they failed to search for better training methods, more humane, more modern training methods.
UCSF declined our request for a tour and interviews with researchers about the Animal Welfare Act violations. In Defense of Animals relies on whistleblowers and labs such as UCSF to alert them to the mistreatment of animals. According to Dr. Elliot Katz, founder and director of the organization, many of the USDA's investigations are actually prompted by such calls, since inspections are so infrequent.
We get calls on the average probably once a month where they won't leave their names. They're scared, but yet they keep saying, IDA, what can you do? Please get the USDA out there. They don't come often enough. And when they did, nothing happened. And the pleadings from us, but they're so afraid of losing their job because it is a small community that if somebody is known as a whistleblower or cause any trouble, they're never going to find another position. And most of these are the low-paid positions.
Dr. Katz says that In Defense of Animals has been successful in preventing some experiments from taking place and provides sanctuaries to rescued animals.
We stopped the breaking of the legs of about 100 greyhounds by the Army at the Presidio. Brain cancer experiments at a research center in Arizona, and an experiment that had been going on for years where they're giving psychotropic drugs to baby monkeys, and it was driving these monkeys totally crazy. And because of the pressure we created, they actually released the monkeys to zoos. But without this pressure coming from the outside, you know, as long as the rhetoric comes out that it's necessary and everything is being conducted humanely, nothing to worry about, they don't take any action. And because they don't take any action, these kinds of things are allowed to continue.
The U.S. National Institutes of Health currently funds medical research at 8 regional primate centers. Every year, over $500 million of taxpayer money is given in grant support to scientists who usually have little contact with the animals they're studying. In Portland, Oregon, a lab technician spoke up about the mistreatment of caged monkeys and found the industry unwilling to take criticism. Correspondent Andrew Stelzer has more.
In April of 1998, Matt Roselle answered a help wanted ad in the paper and soon found himself working a $9 an hour job as a lab technician at the Oregon Regional Primate Research Center. His first day at the center, he was caring for rhesus monkeys, and as Roselle tells the story, it was a shock.
One of the very first rooms I saw was the infant monkeys that all get yanked from their mothers far too soon. They're extremely distressed, crying out. It was clear, even from a layperson's point of view, me not ever being around monkeys, that something was seriously wrong with this situation. We're talking about problems like monkeys showing stereotypies, circling and pacing back and forth, monkeys pulling their hair out of frustration and boredom, monkeys smearing and eating their own feces, drinking their own urine. We had behavior cases for infant neglect, infant abuse. We had monkeys so psychotic, they were literally biting and attacking their own bodies and doing serious damage to themselves.
Roselle had previously worked as an undercover investigator for the animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, documenting and exposing the mistreatment of animals in zoos and farms. This time, however, Roselle said he wanted to try and change the system from the inside. He worked himself into a position as a behavior technician. His job was to care for monkeys that were showing aberrant behavior and try to improve them by using treats, puzzles to occupy their minds, and loose fur so the monkeys would not pull off their own. He also advocated for better treatment, but when his requests were ignored, Roselle called in several anonymous complaints to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. More importantly, while he worked at the Primate Center, Roselle was making secret videotapes of monkeys he said were being mistreated. Roselle says that he was making the tapes just in case he could not change the system from within, and he had to go public. In August of 2000, Roselle did just that. He appeared at a press conference with Dr. Isis Johnson Brown, the former USDA inspector for Oregon for the Animal Welfare Act. Dr. Brown quit her job in frustration at not being allowed to enforce the Animal Welfare Act. She validated Roselle's video footage and said the act is not enforced by the USDA, and even if they tried, the law has a loophole. A facility's own attending vet has final say on whether the animals were psychologically and physically healthy. Brown said at the press conference, quote, "The USDA has a good old boy relationship with the research industry, and the laws are nothing more than smoke and mirrors. More than once, I was instructed by a supervisor to make a personal list of violations of the law, cut that list in half, and then cut that list in half again before writing up my inspection reports. I recognize the system is not set up to protect the animals, but instead the financial interests of the research labs." End quote. Matt Roselle.
The public needs to really look at the source and who has a vested interest in telling the truth or in lying. The people that vigorously defend animal research are exactly the same people that are profiting from it.
Oregon Health Sciences University, which runs the Primate Center, created a website designed to discredit Roselle and deny that they were mistreating animals. However, Roselle's allegations resulted in a Department of Agriculture investigation. Although the USDA cleared the Primate Center of wrongdoing, its top veterinarian resigned. Since Roselle and Brown's statement, OHSU and the Oregon Regional Primate Center have increased security at their facilities and have been reluctant to speak to the media. An OHSU spokesperson refused to be interviewed for this story. However, a former OHSU researcher agreed to speak under condition of anonymity. Laura, a pseudonym, worked from 1998 until 2001, conducting neurological research with rats and guinea pigs. She spoke about the reaction to Roselle and Brown within OHSU's research community.
I don't really think that anyone at OHSU significantly believed him. The general assumption was that the guy was making stuff up and just trying to cause trouble. everyone in that sort of organization is so aware of the control policies and rules as it is that the likelihood of abuse is actually very, very small. It seems almost impossible to happen. There is a number of instances where what he was describing was either just natural behavior of those monkeys or it was essentially manipulated footage.
Rozelle charges that the animal research system is fundamentally flawed.
Animal research really has little or nothing to do with human health. It has to do with money. Tax dollars are being misused. How could you ever get any valid data from an animal that you've created and made into a completely insane animal? I think it's just a matter of time before public consciousness is going to, at least to begin with, to make some serious changes in the care of the animals and funneling some of that money into clinical research that's really going to help people.
For now, OHSU's Primate Center still houses over 2,000 primates. While a spokesperson for OHSU declined to comment on tape, she did provide the following written statement. We believe that reasonable people understand that medical research involving animals is necessary to save and improve human and animal lives. We also explain to people that research animals receive the very best veterinary care and are treated humanely and respectfully. There are some animal rights and animal extremist groups that prey upon people's fears and completely mispresent the way research animals are cared for. The medical research and veterinary community encourages the public to examine all aspects of this issue and make an informed, reasonable opinion. For Making Contact, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information on the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to get in touch with any of our guests, we'll be giving out our toll-free number at the end of this broadcast. In February 2002, an experimental Alzheimer's vaccine that showed promising results in mice hit a major obstacle. Clinical experimentation of the drug on human beings resulted in severe brain inflammation. This has some scientists and concerned citizens asking, how reliable is animal testing? Making Contact's Shireen Marisol Meraji has more.
When rifling through your medicine cabinet looking for aspirin to combat that pounding headache, you probably aren't concerned with its safety. You know that if you take the recommended dose, you'll avoid any life-endangering side effects. In the United States, the Food and Drug Administration regulates the medication that ends up in our local pharmacies. These drugs are subject to tests that can last more than a decade. Almost all of these experiments require animals in preclinical trials. In fact, that aspirin you're about to take has been tested on guinea pigs, rats, mice, and monkeys. Many who support the use of animals in pharmaceutical research say that it's crucial to gauge how a new drug or medical procedure will affect an entire biological system before it's used on human beings. Scientists say that certain species of animals have physiological systems that are strikingly similar to humans. Therefore, experimenting on animals will provide the data needed to go to the next stage of testing, human trials. Dr. Wise Young was recognized by Time magazine as one of the best in science and medicine for his spinal cord research. He developed a steroid therapy called methylprednisolone. When given to a victim of acute spinal cord injury within the first 8 hours, methylprednisolone will help stimulate the recovery of a percentage of spinal cord tissue. Dr. Young said that he would not have been able to test methylprednisolone on people if he hadn't observed its effects on cats first.
Animals were essential for methylprednisolone to get into clinical trial. I must say that, you know, this is it's an example of what animal studies can do as a result of experiments in a series of animals, cats in particular. We're currently treating maybe as many as 100,000 people around the world every year with this drug and improving their recovery.
Dr. Ray Greek is the president of Americans for Medical Advancement and author of Sacred Cows and Golden Geese, The Human Costs of Experiments on Animals. He says that though the FDA required Dr. Wise Young to use animals before testing methylprednisolone on humans, it was not medically necessary. Dr. Greek says Dr. Wise-Young got most of his data by observing patients suffering from brain injuries who were given a similar high-dose steroid therapy.
This is a very common theme in medicine. For example, again, going back to the HIV-positive population, the cocktails that they take were based on cocktails that cancer patients take. So this idea of taking a cocktail actually was a human clinical observation. And that was the same thing with Dr. Weiss's research. Matter of fact, there are people who have done high-dose steroid tests on animals suffering from spinal cord injuries and found that the spinal cord injuries were actually made worse. There are several articles in journals like Surgical Neurology, the Journal of Neurosurgery, etc., where these experiments were done. And if Dr. Weiss had studied that literature, he would have never given the first high-dose steroid to a spinal cord injured patient.
When asked to respond to critics' claims that experiments on animals may not produce the same results in human subjects, Dr. Wise-Young said that animal testing is still the most reliable option.
I think animal models are the best that we have at the present time. We certainly cannot do it on computers. We certainly will not be able to just test drugs willy-nilly on people. We must know to some degree that it works in animals. This is true of almost every drug that people currently use in this country and worldwide. Almost every drug has had its genesis from animal studies.
Alex Fano is author of Lethal Laws, Animal Testing, Human Health, and Environmental Policy. She's also the coordinator for the Medical Research Modernization Committee in New York City. According to Fano, there have been a number of drugs throughout history that were found to be safe when tested on animals, but turned out to be dangerous to people.
You can try a drug on thousands of mice or rats all you want, but the first people that take those drugs are actually the first guinea pigs, so to speak. So there are three phases of clinical trials on humans before a drug can be marketed. You know, animal safety studies that precede these human clinical trials haven't prevented dangerous drugs from getting to the market at all. I have a list in front of me of at least a dozen types of drugs, including oral contraceptives, which cause blood clots in humans that were found to be perfectly safe in animal experiments.
According to the Journal of the American Medical Association, adverse reactions to drugs are the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. In 1998, Rezulin, a diabetes drug, was taken off the market. The FDA approved Rezulin, but was forced to recall the drug after 90 people suffered liver failure. 63 of those people died. Dr. Greek.
That drug was tested on a number of different species of animals, none of which exhibited liver toxicity. And this is a story that goes back centuries. In the 19th century, animal models actually led scientists to believe that diabetes was a disease of the liver, not a disease of the pancreas. The drug penicillin, probably the biggest contribution to human survival of the 20th century, the drug penicillin was delayed for over a decade because Alexander Fleming tested it in a rabbit, and it did not cure the systemic infection in a rabbit.
The Federal Drug Administration requires testing for most pharmaceutical drugs on at least two different species of animal before human beings are phased into clinical trials. Dr. Ray Greek says that pharmaceutical companies use these regulations to their advantage.
You can always find an animal that says your drug is a good drug. Your competition, on the other hand, can always find an animal that says your drug causes cancer. And both animals are correct. It's just that is what the drug does in that particular species. It has no correlation to what the drug will do in a human being.
When conducting research for her book, Fano says she came across examples of pharmaceutical companies who were successful in manipulating the regulatory system. She says that the pharmaceutical industry can ignore the results of animal tests when it's convenient.
There were 23 carcinogenicity studies, cancer studies, and also 16 dermal irritancy studies in rodents with benzoyl peroxide, which is a popular over-the-counter acne cream, you know, that's been on the market for 30 years. And there were positive results in the sense that skin tumors were obtained in one particularly sensitive mouse strain called the Senkar mouse strain. And Procter & Gamble, which makes this popular anti-acne ointment containing benzoyl peroxide, dismissed these mouse studies, claiming that they were poorly done, that human evidence contradicted them because humans did not produce skin tumors, and that the mouse skin tumors only occurred under specific experimental conditions and only with specific mouse strains, and furthermore, that mouse and human skin are significantly different physiologically. It's really this kind of politically and financially motivated disagreement over the significance of animal test results, which sometimes leads to a call for more animal tests to prove or disprove a desired theory. It's sort of easier to market a product when you can find an animal test that essentially gives you the result that you want. Or you can just get a result that you don't like and say, well, the animal test doesn't really make sense because, you know, this really doesn't happen in the human situation.
Dr. Grieg adds that as long as the drug is tested on animals and approved for human clinical trials, the pharmaceutical company is not financially liable for any negative effects on people. According to Public Citizen, a public advocacy research organization, the pharmaceutical industry has more lobbyists than there are members of Congress, and over half are either former members of Congress or congressional staffers. And a USA Today study found that more than half of the experts hired to advise the FDA on the safety and effectiveness of medicines had a direct financial interest in the drug they were asked to evaluate. According to Grieg, the FDA continues to require animal testing because it works in the pharmaceutical industry's favor.
A very good example of the revolving door between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry is the drug Resulin. The LA Times did a series of excellent articles showing that most people who sat on that board to recommend Resulin were actually employed in some form or fashion by Warner Lambert, the people who manufactured the drug.
The FDA did not answer to our request for an interview to respond to these claims. Research is being done on alternatives to animal testing all over the world. In Europe, the use of animals in biomedical research is dropping because of the rise in vitro studies, epidemiological research, and computer software, which can simulate the human response to certain drugs. In France, the number of laboratory animals fell from 7 million in 1980 to 2.6 million in 1997, according to the European Center for the Validation of Alternative Methods. In the United States, any alternative to animal testing goes through a rigorous validation process that may take years to complete. But the FDA hasn't held animal testing to the same standards. According to Anita O'Connor, an FDA representative, quote, "Most of the animal tests we accept have never been validated. They evolved over the last 20 years, and the FDA is comfortable with them." For Making Contact, I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at animal testing and medical research. Thanks for listening, and special thanks to Rosalind Fay for editorial assistance and to Damian Irizarry for production assistance. Philip Babbage is our managing producer, Laura Lavati, managing director, Peggy Law, executive director, Shireen Meraji, co-producer, administrative coordinator, Rosalind Fay, women's desk director, Lisa Redman, senior advisor, Norman Solomon, national producer, David Barsamian, and I'm your host and co-producer, Stephanie Welch. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to reach any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, 800-529-5736. You can also check out our website at www.radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.